Hello, I'm Mariet Snyman. Welcome to Calm, Clear and Helpful, a weekly podcast series on taking good care of yourself and others. Introducing you to wellness professionals ready to assist with sincerity and care. Today's topic is how to cope when your partner has a chronic illness. My guest is Lida Lies Grobler, educational psychologist from Pretoria. Welcome, Lida Lies.
Thanks, Mariette. It's very lovely to be here.
To our listeners, thank you for joining us. During our conversation, Lida Lies will give us practical advice not only on how to support your partner with chronic illness, but also on self-care. And then it will be fun question time. Lida Lies, can you please tell us more about your work?
Yes, definitely. I think a lot of people don't necessarily have the privilege that I feel I have, and maybe a lot of psychologists, but I personally feel that there's almost no day that goes by that I feel sure I really am where I'm supposed to be, and how incredible to be able to sit with people and share their deepest part of themselves. Because I think that's a big part of what I feel my work entails, is I'm here to be able to mirror back to people in a non-subjective, non-emotionally involved way to show them who they are, to help them find meaning, to give them the chance to potentially reparent themselves in a way that they might not have received when they were young. And I think the reason why it's so valuable is that we often don't get that chance anywhere else, because there's always some kind of engagement that the other person might have to us that makes it difficult to really give a reflective mirror back in a non-involved way. So I think a part of what my work entails is to make sure that I allow them to, as cliche as this sounds, to become whole again. So we sometimes use the example of a reason why we are so fragmented when we are adults is because we have let go of parts of ourselves as we grew up. And that therapy's aim is actually to allow for the different orphans of consciousness to come back. So all the little parts that we've kind of denied along the way, maybe the needs that weren't met and that we thought we need to be okay with, or the spaces in which we were really hurt and we experienced trauma. If we can allow ourselves to let all those little parts of us come back, then the cliche of becoming whole is possible. And my feeling is that that's a big part of what my work entails. So if we look at who the population would be that an educational psychologist serves, it's not necessary to say that we work with children all the time. I've actually seen people whose children are as old as I am. So it's really across the surface, but it has to do with the content of what we're working with. So an educational psychologist would often work preventatively, whereas a clinical psychologist would work almost curatively on the other side. So we try to find and catch things before they become a long-term problem. And I think that's what gives my work so much hope in a way. So if I really just have to summarize it, I think my work is working with hope in a world that sometimes feels as if it's on fire.
Oh, thank you for that clear summary. Yeah, I think your work gives people hope indeed, and I am looking forward to what we are now going to discuss. Lida Lies, many people I know have a partner with a chronic illness. Do you often see this in your practice?
Mariette, yes, I do, but actually not nearly enough. And what I mean by that is that in South Africa, the statistics according to the World Health Organization and our Department of Health actually indicates that 1 in 5 adults have a chronic disease. So what this then means is that if I don't see that statistic reflected in a full practice, it probably means that people do not understand that this is something that they do not have to navigate by themselves. That this is something that really, really needs enough support to be able to understand all the nooks and crannies of the impact that it has. Because, yes, the person with a chronic illness will definitely be impacted in more ways than one. But it will also spiral out to their immediate environment, which obviously includes their loved ones. It includes their work. It includes their functionality on a daily life. So in short, yes, I definitely do see it, but I would almost want to see it more. I think there's a lot of people who's struggling and suffering more than is needed because they're trying to navigate this alone.
Yes. And you know, since I've become aware of everything surrounding chronic illness, I've realized that I don't really always know what chronic illness entails. Could you tell us how you define chronic illness?
Yes, without a doubt. I think your question is very relevant because there's a little bit of a difference between giving the definition from a medical perspective and then also giving a definition from a psychological perspective. So if we look medically, we would probably say that it is a chronic medical illness, which refers to a long-lasting health condition that typically persists for more than 3 to 6 months and that then often requires ongoing medical engagement and behavioral adaptation. Psychologically, however, we would see it as a life-altering experience that challenges a person's sense of self, their coping resources, their relationships, and their mental well-being. So you see how the one kind of feels a little bit cold almost. Mm-hmm. Like the medical perspective gives a bit of a general, even abstract explanation. Whereas if we look at the psychological perspective, we really indicate that it's life-altering. We're not saying there's just a little bit of a change on this or a little bit of a change on that. It changes our life experience completely. And it doesn't necessarily have to just change it for the negative. It can actually also change it to the positive. We often see that in relationships, if navigated well, it can actually bring people closer. It can bring a lot of value, but we need to then see it, identify it, and respond to it effectively.
Could you offer some examples of chronic illness?
Yes, without a doubt. There's so many different ones that I think we sometimes get lost in whether it is regarded as a chronic illness or not. So diabetes is a chronic illness. Epilepsy is a chronic illness. Asthma is a chronic illness. Rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, celiac disease, fibromyalgia, chronic migraine, chronic back pain or joint pain, HIV and AIDS, and even psychiatric conditions. There's some people who would indicate that it's not necessarily medically labeled as a chronic medical illness, but the impact of it is very similar to what I explained initially, right, about what the psychological explanation of a chronic illness would be. So a life-altering experience would also be found in major depressive disorder, specifically the recurrent manifestation of it, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, generalized anxiety disorder. So there's so many different things that can actually bring up a chronic response and necessitates a chronic response from our side. Specifically anything that indicates chronic pain. There's often also people that walk around with things that cannot necessarily be labeled. There's a lot of people who walk around with pain that cannot be given a specific, let's say, name to it. And that often can almost be even more difficult than having a diagnosed label towards what one is experiencing. It's as if in that diagnosis, there is a sense of power because then you know what to deal with. So in a way, if people are struggling with some kind of physical or emotional difficulty that cannot be explained, they definitely need to be in some version of additional support so that they can navigate that process.
Chronic illness or chronic pain is often invisible in air commas, not only to outsiders, but also to loved ones. Could you comment?
Now, chronic illness is often actually, we would sometimes even use the word invisible illness when somebody would be in the practice, which actually just refers to a condition that doesn't have obvious physical signs. So unlike a broken bone or a visible injury where somebody, for example, is bleeding, Conditions like chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, migraines, or autoimmune diseases, or even depression may not show on the outside like the broken bone or the visible blood, but they profoundly affect daily functioning and quality of life. And that's why it's sometimes so difficult to navigate, because people on the outside experience it very differently to people on the inside. So I sometimes use an abbreviation to explain the impact. I use the word NILL, N-I-L-L. And I think the NILL to me has such resonance because it actually refers to a word that would mean nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So the first would be to not being believed or taken seriously. So that's the N, not being believed or taken seriously. And it's often because somebody who would have been diagnosed with a chronic disease often feel dismissed by their friends, sometimes family, by employers, or even medical professionals. I think that has been the most profound to me, is to actually realize how sometimes somebody with chronic pain would go to a medical professional whose aim it would be or should be to help, but they themselves almost make the patient feel as if, oh, they're just being sensitive. So common invalidating remarks, for example, could include, but you don't look sick. You were fine yesterday. Everyone gets tired sometimes. Almost as if we're trying to tell them, just be better, right? So that's definitely the first difficulty within this invisible illness, is not being believed or taken seriously. Then the next one is internalizing doubt. So because these symptoms aren't visible and people respond to them in quite a dismissing way, those individuals may start to doubt their own experience, wondering if they're exaggerating or imagining it. It's almost as if they're gaslighting themselves. And in a lot of ways, this can lead to guilt, to shame, to emotional isolation. Guilt because of the fact that they feel as if they're putting such a burden on other people for something that might not even be that big. Or feel shame for the fact that they continue to struggle with certain things that other people reckon they're supposed to get over. It might go to the emotional isolation because of the fact that they almost distance themselves from other people because they feel so bad in their vicinity or in their proximity that they just decide to deal with this by themselves because they can't just wish it away. It's not a button that they press. Then the third one is loneliness in relationships. So that's the first L of NILL. It's often because loved ones often underestimate the daily toll that this illness takes on a physical, emotional, and mental level. And often even well-meaning partners or family members can grow impatient or resentful or emotionally distant if they don't understand the chronic fluctuating nature of the illness. So a loss of identity and validation is then the fourth one. So it's the second L. Many people with invisible conditions feel like their identity is split between an outside self that appears very normal, but then an inner self that's often exhausted, in pain, or mentally overwhelmed. And that can be a very difficult thing to navigate and take forward, because without visible cues, they lack societal recognition. And that invisibility can delay diagnosis and appropriate care. So they often feel so almost stupid about it, that they don't explain the intensity of what they're feeling, and they could actually have been helped. And the impact on the spiral around them, their loved ones, their work, etc., could actually have been mitigated a little bit if they can get the right diagnosis and appropriate care. So what does this NILL abbreviation kind of bring these individuals often to? And that is that they often feel that they need to prove their pain. So they need to prove their suffering sometimes in different ways. Sometimes they need to go to work or social events despite the pain to avoid being seen as unreliable. Or they often need to minimize their symptoms to seem strong. Or conversely, they have to overexplain themselves in an effort to be understood. And I mean, if we just listen to this, we can think how this creates a true cycle of emotional exhaustion, which in itself worsens the illness.
Yes. When one thinks about it in the way you explain it, this is no small thing, right?
No, not at all. I think that's a big part of the difficulty, is that it seems like NILL, like nothing.
Mm.
But it is, in its intensity, it's actually ridiculous to think that one person has to deal with this.
Mm. Lida Lise, in which ways can chronic illness impact a love relationship?
Sure, there's so many different ones, actually. So I'm going to try and touch on all of them. I think one of the biggest ones probably is that there's a shift in roles and responsibilities. So in some ways, the amount of let's say even chores divided, duties divided in terms of finances, household tasks, sometimes even childcare, now gets divided in a different way to before. And therefore the partner without a diagnosis need to take on more duties, which often can lead to a sense of resentment or fatigue or just a feeling of imbalance. The partner with the diagnosis, however, because of this change in roles, may often feel guilt or helplessness, often a loss of identity, especially if they previously saw themselves as the strong or capable one. You'll hear here that I'm not referring to the healthy partner and the ill partner, because we want to make sure that the person's identity does not have to become that in both cases. The person who's potentially taking more of a care role and the person who's in a space where they really struggle to do the things that they usually were able to do on a daily basis. So we're trying to explain that the diagnosis is something that's in their life, but it is not their life. So that's the first, is a shift in roles and responsibilities. Then the next one would be changes in communication between the different people, with, let's say, within a relationship. I wanted to say a family as well, but for the moment, let's focus on the relationship. So often the illness may become like a third party. It's as if there's this huge thing that's always on the table. There's this huge thing that we always have to talk about. And then it might happen that partners actually avoid difficult conversations. So that might be the change in communication that we see. And this can, without a doubt, create emotional distance. On the other hand, however, the positive change in communication that it might bring is that if they can allow themselves to be honest with each other, to have compassion within the space, to both sides, right? Not just compassion to the partner with a diagnosis, but also compassion to the partner without the diagnosis. This illness can actually prompt deep, intimate dialogue, but only if there's emotional safety. And that's why I say it's almost strange to me to think that the statistics in my practice do not reflect the 1 out of 5, because creating emotional safety within communication in a relationship is often something that needs to be created in a therapeutic space. Then the third one is emotional strain and burnout. So the partner with the diagnosis may experience depression, anxiety, mood fluctuations, which can alter the emotional landscape of the relationship incredibly so. And the partner without a diagnosis may feel overwhelmed, scared, or even trapped, especially when care needs are high. So both partners might grieve the old version of their relationship and fear the certainty of what lies ahead. So a big part of what's needed here is that if people don't speak, as we indicated before, if they cannot have a deep and intimate dialogue within this emotional safety, emotional strain and burnout isn't something that they just navigate. It is something that might break them. Then the following one is an impact on emotional intimacy. Sure, if one's body is ridden with pain, there's often fatigue and there's medication side effects, for example, it can definitely have a decrease in sexual desire, in physical closeness, or sometimes even the ability to be physically affectionate. So from the person with the diagnosis side, the ability to be able to touch and to give a hug, because sometimes it just hurts too much, but also maybe even the desire to want that. The okay feeling of when you give me a hug, it makes me feel held, it makes me feel safe, it makes me feel cared for, as opposed to it actually hurts me. It makes me feel on fire. There's so many things that can happen when there is a chronic diagnosis that really makes touch quite painful. And that's sometimes so difficult for the partner without a diagnosis to really understand. Body image changes also happen. Scars, for example, or medical devices that can lead to self-consciousness or shifts in attraction. Unless openly talked about and gently navigated, these things can also then create a big barrier between partners. You can also think that what's difficult here is we're speaking about people that potentially are already in a relationship. And in that space, one person gets a diagnosis, which means that there's already a basis of trust and care and having each other's best interests at heart that was created, which means that you can almost fall back on the foundation that has been set. But what happens if a person has a chronic diagnosis and they're not already in a relationship? That is a conversation that can also, that can keep us busy for very long because of the fact that that puts a different kind of pressure and consciousness on the person with the diagnosis if they have to share that with someone else that they don't necessarily have a foundation with yet. Then the fifth one is a loss of shared activities or future plans, meaning that things that potentially now change are the things that they can do together. Sometimes even the things that they can do by themselves. There's a lot of medical care that's needed, as we indicate here, that obviously costs money. And what then might happen is that the amount of income that they have to use on things that potentially can be fun or new or different or that's just hobby related potentially cannot happen in the same way because of physical limitations or the financial strain that I indicated. So what often then actually needs to happen is a bit of a recalibration of joy, which might mean that they have to almost grieve what has happened before. And this can actually be quite valuable. If people can navigate these things well and they can continue to speak to each other, what we actually see is they might find intimacy and fun in smaller, slower, or more home-based ways, which in itself is mindfulness to the T. And if we're saying that mindfulness can allow us to be present and to be in the moment and to actually experience a different sense of deeper joy, this might actually be the call. A diagnosis, a chronic diagnosis, might be the call to being able to see the value in the small, the joy in the mundane. And then number six is trust, security, and dependency that changes. So chronic illness can make one partner physically or emotionally dependent on the other. I mean, then you can think, right, that if not handled with sensitivity, it can really trigger power imbalances, especially if the partner without a diagnosis begins to feel more like a caregiver than a lover. And I will definitely say, if finance would allow, and if the diagnosis is of the nature where a caregiver, an additional caregiver is needed, that if they can, even if they have to give other things up, that they should. So that those roles don't get too mixed up, that we don't replace the one for the other, and that we can actually be able to compartmentalize the caregiving activities away from the loving activities. In 90% of cases, however, it's not possible. And then it will be very necessary for both people to be able to say, how do we shift from the one role to the other role? Sometimes even it might be a change in clothing. Sometimes it might even be to make sure that there is certain times throughout a week where we particularly are just in a relationship together, whether that means that we have a particular meal together, whether that means that we have a check-in and we speak about anything other than the diagnosis, because it can sometimes take over a space so much. So what we're actually saying here is that trust, security, and dependency can be something that, if handled with sensitivity, can actually deepen trust. And then the last one is a potential for growth and deepened connection. It's also something that can be a positive impact because of a chronic diagnosis, as I indicated before. Some couples actually report that facing illness brings them closer. It creates a stronger bond through shared resilience, tenderness, and gratitude. Something that I feel is such a nice sentence to mention is that it can create a shift from a performance-based love to a presence-based love. And I'm going to say that again. It can create a shift from a performance-based love to a presence-based love, which allows for, instead of doing things and being functional together, we can actually say, hey, now we're together with each other. And this is the thing that keeps us together. This is the thing that creates an awareness of our companionship, of care for each other, of empathy. So that to me is a very important thing to realize. And I think therefore, what we're actually saying here is that it doesn't just need to have negative impacts on the relationship. It can actually have positive impacts as well. And what's going to make the difference between those two is honest communication. I think you potentially have already realized that I'm really pushing to say that counseling can make a huge difference in that. So if possible, without a doubt, counseling, often individually so, and then couples therapy. Because often the individual part is actually what allows for the strength within the couple coming together. Then making sure that because of this open communication, people can make sure that they express where they are at and they can find a way forward. And in that, they can also make sure that they get the support that they need. So chronic illness changes the relationship without a doubt, but it doesn't have to end it. It invites a different kind of love, one that's patient, adaptable, and emotionally rich.
That is quite a mouthful, but it's profound. Thank you. Now, Lida Lise, something completely different. What are flare-ups?
Okay, so depending on what chronic diagnosis you have, flare-ups potentially might look different. So it might look different for rheumatoid arthritis or for chronic fatigue syndrome or for multiple sclerosis. But the principle is that it is a sudden onset of symptoms that worsens quite quickly and often sometimes without warning. So we can say that it is temporary, but just understand that the temporary might not be like 10 minutes and then it's over. It might last hours, it might last days, it might even last weeks. What we are saying is that it is not the constant baseline. So it is even more intense than it usually is. And usually it might be quite bad. If we're saying on a scale, the usual baseline might be that it is to the intensity of a 5 out of 10, which is really high already. But then a flare-up might be that it takes it all the way to an 8 out of 10 for a day or for a week. So it's important to understand that we're not saying that a flare-up means that suddenly you have a symptom and under normal circumstances you don't. We're actually saying that it becomes worse than it has been before. And then obviously we can say that it's quite disruptive, right? It can interfere with daily work, with daily life, with emotional well-being, with relationships during that time. And each flare-up can present differently in severity and symptoms than the one before. Obviously, there's value in trying to get curious about flare-ups, being able to say, what can be triggers for my specific flare-ups or for my partner's specific flare-ups, so that we can almost get a bit of a protocol about how to deal with these. Common triggers for it, for example, can be physical or emotional stress, sometimes additional or outside infections, sometimes even changes in weather or environment, hormonal changes, overexertion, poor sleep or nutrition. So if we know these things, if we realize that we haven't slept well for a week, we need to know that it's potentially going to have an impact. And therefore, our flare-up protocol, almost like pre-flare-up and post-flare-up, needs to almost be put into place. So the more these flare-ups happen, yes, I think the more it can unsettle us. If we only see it as, oh, it's here, I don't know what to do. If, however, we can also see that flare-up as an opportunity to learn and understand the landscape of the flare-up, it can really help to know how to go about it. How can we additionally reduce stress? Or how can we try and say, all right, we realize that it has been based on poor sleep. How do we change that? Or we have had a very tough week with a lot of things that needed to happen. Would there be a way to get the next week to be at a slower pace? So there's so many things that can be done if we see a flare-up not as something that we don't want and we kind of judge it and we feel really bad about it, but something that can help us to understand the nuance of our particular situation. Maybe it's valuable to know that common symptoms during a flare-up might be increased pain, heightened fatigue, often a worsening in inflammation, and then a definite experience of brain fog. So if we can start seeing what the symptoms might be and what we see in terms of our own flare-up process, it can help us to have these protocol pre and protocol post in place.
My next question is, why is it important that the partner without the diagnosis develops an understanding of the illness that their beloved is living with?
So I think understanding is needed because it can aim to facilitate empathy. Not understanding often facilitates only agreement. And what agreement in a sense says is it's devoid of feeling. And that often creates the emotional distancing or the emotional isolation or detachment that really makes relationships not supportive, but actually one of the things that adds weight. So without understanding, we cannot really put empathy into the picture. And without that, we're actually saying that relationship strife will be created rather than relationship resilience. So again, understanding equals empathy. Empathy allows for relationship resilience. Not understanding facilitates agreement, and agreement creates relationship strife. So the principle of this is just that knowledge forms a foundation for stability and sustainable support. So if we're saying that we need to understand, it is because we want to make sure that we can give both parties, not just the one who has the diagnosis, but also the one without the diagnosis, a sense of emotional validation. We want to be able to tell the person with the diagnosis that I can't fix it, but I get it, and I'm with you. And those words can be profoundly healing. Understanding will also reduce misinterpretation and conflict. It makes it easier then for the person who is without the diagnosis to not take things personally and to not make unfair judgment. It reduces resentment, unnecessary arguments, and blame to both sides. Understanding might help things like reading invisible symptoms as laziness, disinterest, or moodiness, as opposed to pain and fatigue. It can also help both partners to actually be equipped enough to work as a team, because better communication and joint problem solving will immediately be part of the picture. If they can understand, they can make adjustments to routines, they can set shared boundaries, potentially even with other family members. And in this way, they can allow themselves to become more flexible. As I indicated before, preparing for flare-ups and changing the needs that comes with that and kind of like meeting the needs that comes with that is much easier if we do understand. This will almost lead to a practical readiness, to a more calmer, safer environment to both people. Don't think people always realize that this is not only for the partner with the diagnosis. If there's understanding, it creates such a level of relief and release actually for the partner without the diagnosis. So in this way, with understanding, we can also make sure that the partner with a diagnosis, their dignity in a sense is preserved, because it helps the other partner without the diagnosis to avoid unhelpful advice and unrealistic expectations, which makes the person diagnosed feel as if somebody understands, somebody knows, somebody is not going to pressure me or put unrealistic expectations on what I can add today or what I cannot do. And we're also saying that understanding will protect the relationship from burnout, because compassion fatigue, in the same way that psychologists can sometimes get compassion fatigue, the partner without the diagnosis also run the same risk. And in our training, what they usually tell us to try and determine whether we are currently suffering from it or we are just tired and asleep will probably better that, is when we get frustrated with people who do not take action, or when we get frustrated with people who is experiencing something difficult. And I find that that's a very helpful way of actually determining whether you have that, even in this situation. So with understanding, we can try and combat the compassion fatigue or the frustration or the emotional withdrawal that sometimes does happen. I think understanding will probably also help partners to both sides to set healthier limits, because they're informed and they're realistic about the illness's cause and impact. And I also think that understanding will allow a couple to grow together continuously. So it really fosters a sense of resilience, shared purpose. And I think in that way, people can get each other in an often more deeper way. A big reason for why we often say that relationships after a few years might dwindle and the love might feel as if it dissipates more is actually because of the fact that people do not understand each other on a deeper level. The beginning part of relationships will only sustain you for a while. It's definitely not going to take you for the longer haul. And if we are indicating that a chronic diagnosis can actually help a relationship to become deeper, for people to understand each other deeper, to both sides again, not just the person with a diagnosis, but also the person without the diagnosis, because it's definitely going to trigger you. There's definitely deep-seated, rooted wounds of both people that will come up. If this can be managed with a sense of compassion, with empathy and understanding, I think you potentially found the key, a key to a reliable, supportive, loving, connected relationship. Does this make sense?
It does. Do you have any advice regarding how one can develop this understanding?
Oh, so much. But let's start with maybe one sentence that I'm going to repeat twice and then maybe a little bit deeper. So the first one is ask, but with genuine interest. Ask to understand. Ask gently, so with curiosity and without judgment. So ask with genuine interest, with gentle curiosity and without judgment. Because the person who actually knows this the best is the person that's going through it. If you can be the partner without the diagnosis and go about your partner's illness through intentional learning, open-hearted communication, and emotional attunement, all the potential difficulties that we've already spoken about, the likelihood of that happening is much smaller. So in principle, what we're saying is educate yourself. And this lies on two levels. The one level is read reputable medical sources. So Mayo Clinic or something from the NHS or disease-specific foundations that also have a lot of information. But this is only almost the academic version of this. This will explain to you potentially what will happen in this person's body. But what we also want is we want some version of you understanding the experience of it. And the tip for this would be to read subreddits. But when you do it, understand that that in itself now comes from people who potentially also wrote that in a very emotionally unstable space. They might have written it in a space where they actually wanted their own partner to be able to see this, and therefore they almost share it with the world. So know that everything that's read there needs to kind of go through your own filter a little bit. But it can be so valuable if you use that subreddit to discuss that with your partner, to see what is it that they agree with? What is it that's not the same for them? What is it like for them in the same way? Is this something that you wish I could understand? So know that that education definitely needs to go to two sides, the medical, academic side, but then almost the personal, emotional side, and allow that to become a discussion. Then we also say that often asking a health professional is actually a big part of what my hope would be, that this individual would be able to bring in both aspects, the academic side and the emotional side. So let's say almost like the cognitive side and then also the emotional side, so that you can speak about limitations, about treatments, questions about understanding symptoms. And if you guys can do that together, the partner without the diagnosis can ask whether this is the same, whether the explanation is in fact what the partner with the diagnosis is experiencing. So the tip here would be to focus on the how it affects daily life and not just on the what of the illness. So the how it affects daily life and not just the what of the illness, because the what might not be enough. So I think valuable questions, if you're having ongoing conversations, could be like, what do you wish I understood better? Or what's it like for you when your symptoms flare? And it is okay if, as the partner without the diagnosis, you don't always understand or get it. Because a big part of you might not, because you haven't been there. You do not have to understand in order to have empathy. But it's always good to be interested enough in trying to understand the most of it that you can. So much so that my suggestion would be that within this understanding, a part of what I would suggest you read is Brené Brown's explanation on empathy, and then also how we sometimes miss, we have a good intention, but we miss showing empathy because of the way in which we express ourselves. And this is taken up in a book called The Atlas of the Heart by Brené Brown. I think this just allows for the education process where you're asking someone about wanting to understand how you can respond to facilitate a further conversation. Because often empathy misses where we kind of just jump in to give advice, or where we, in a sense, feel sympathy as opposed to empathy, actually makes it much more difficult for that person to continue to have the conversation. And then it's not an ongoing open conversation anymore.
Then, Lida Lees, what can help the partner without the diagnosis understand the needs of the other person?
Sure. In a way, this comes down to a very similar thing, right? Ask, listen, really listen. Clarify to make sure that you've understood and listened carefully enough. And then here I want to say that it needs to go both ways. So yes, the partner without the diagnosis wants to understand the partner with the diagnosis. But if we don't make this conversation both ways, in my experience, it's very difficult to really find a way forward. So both is needed. So ask, listen, clarify, and then find a way forward. Find a way forward that feels as if it can work for both people. So this is what I'm going to say next is a couples counseling principle that we always try to find. And that is to say that it doesn't necessarily have to be only my way or only my partner's way. We need to try and find a third way that make both of us feel comfortable enough. It might not make us feel as comfortable if it was either my way or it was my partner's way. But something that is additional to that, maybe somewhere in between, that we are both comfortable enough with. So part of understanding these needs has to do with realizing that the needs will definitely come up. Some of it will be easily met. Some of them might not. So to each other, ask, listen, clarify to both ways, and then find a third way forward.
Thank you. Individuals with chronic illness often have very little energy compared to healthy individuals. Could you comment?
Yes, I think there's actually a very apt theory that we often use to explain a little bit about how this happens and how people can try and explain having very little energy to the people around them. So the theory is called the spoon theory. And it was created by Christine, I'm not always sure if I pronounce her surname correctly, Misurandino. And she actually herself lived with lupus. She used this actually to describe what it is like to live with limited energy. And she used spoons to represent the units of energy. So the theory would say that while a healthy person might have what seems like unlimited or renewable energy, a person with a chronic illness starts each day with a set number of spoons. Far fewer than most people, and each activity costs spoons. So this might apply to physical energy, but also to emotional energy. So I want to make an example. In physical energy, maybe getting out of bed costs one spoon, showering costs two spoons, making a meal costs 2 to 3 spoons, going to work costs 4 to 6 spoons. Attending a social event costs 3 to 5 spoons. So if the person with a diagnosis wakes up that morning and they start with only 6 to 8 spoons, once they're gone, they're gone. There's no borrowing from tomorrow without paying a price, like a flare-up or pain or exhaustion. So if they go beyond their 8 spoons for today, there might be a big chance that the flare-up is something that they can expect in a few days, or maybe even the next day. And this might be on an emotional level too. So emotional tasks might be managing pain without showing it, takes 1 spoon. Responding to texts or calls is 1 or 2 spoons. Pretending to be okay in public takes 2 spoons. Or handling disappointment or guilt is 2 to 3 spoons. So emotional labor might be invisible, but it's still draining. So it is important to understand that we want to be able to get to a place where we can actually say, all right, if we wake up today, okay, how many spoons do you have? To kind of check in and see whether the person with a diagnosis has the capacity to deal with what needs to happen today. So if what they have to do today will require 10 spoons and they only have 8, maybe there's value in the partner without the diagnosis to actually ask, okay, what can I do to help you save a spoon or two? To kind of ask what it is today that one can do that can potentially just take the pressure off a little bit. Things that would go above and beyond what's usually happening. And you can think that this is only possible if the day almost starts with how many spoons do you think you have today? And then I think something that I want to introduce here too is because of the fact that chronic diagnosis has a spiral effect also around the person with a diagnosis. It is important to understand that the person who is the partner without the diagnosis also start falling into the space of having spoons and that it's not always renewable for them either. So it is good to know that this actually needs to go to both sides as well, right? How many spoons do I have? How many spoons do you have? What is it that we can potentially do today to make it easier to manage? How can we support each other? What can we maybe even cancel to save both of us spoons? So know that sometimes a big part of what we need to realize within a chronic diagnosis is that the amount of spoons you have will be inconsistent. One day we might have 8, the other day we might have 4. So one day they might seem fine, the next one they're in bed. This isn't laziness, it's energy budgeting. And we actually want to encourage energy budgeting. How great would it be if somebody with a chronic diagnosis knows themselves so well that they realize today waking up, I cannot overextend myself if I want to deal with something tomorrow. So for example, they often need to make constant trade-offs. So for example, if I clean the kitchen, I might not have the energy to go out later. And then they will sometimes prioritize essentials and decline invitations because they don't have enough spoons. And a part of that is actually brilliant. It's brilliant to see how people can say, I have only 8 spoons. What am I going to use it for today? And that shouldn't be something that we get frustrated about. It's something that we should actually feel sure this person is quite self-aware within quite tough phase of their life, of their illness, of their day. Make sense?
Does. Very sensible.
Okay.
I was wondering, when your partner has a chronic illness, should you take into account their personality?
Absolutely. When your partner has a chronic illness, it's essential to take into account their personality because support isn't a one-size-fits-all. And the more attuned you are to who they are, not just how they suffer, the more your care becomes an act of love and not just assistance. So I want to say that again. The more you are attuned to who they are and not just how they suffer, the more your care becomes an act of love, not just assistance. Because a chronic illness doesn't erase who a person is. It just adds a new layer to how they live, cope, and relate. And we have to understand that people cope differently, right? So for example, a practical independent person might prefer solutions and structure over emotional support. So they might not want you to faff around how they're emotionally feeling, but they might want you to help to see how today are we going to make sure that food is being made if I don't have the capacity. But an emotional expressive partner might need to process and be heard more than fixed. And if for this person you give solutions all the time, they will feel unheard. So somebody, for example, who values privacy or stoicism might feel smothered by too much hovering or worry. And the idea here is to understand the type of person that you're working with. Do not step into, a potential hole that makes the coping even more difficult, but a coping that is truly tailored to them. The only thing that I wanted to add to that was just to say that a big part of personality is actually what helps us to understand how an individual processes life and how they will feel more respected when we engage with them. So we can't just say that personality goes out the door when a chronic illness is part of the picture and therefore we go about it in a very one-size-fits-all way. It needs to be something that allows a person to still be seen for who they are and that they also have a diagnosis. They do not have to be defined by their illness. They are still who they are. This just gave an additional layer.
Do you have advice regarding ways in which the partner without the diagnosis can offer their beloved practical support?
Yes. Again, I want to say ask. So ask, what would make things feel just a little easier for you today? When this question can be respectful, gentle, and focused on them, it can really make them feel as if they're not alone. And then it can come down to things like cooking or prepping meals, for example, cleaning or doing laundry, grocery shopping or errands. But always in order to make sure that we give them the autonomy that often they need. And again, this might be more pronounced for certain personality types than others. But if we are saying that we want to respect that autonomy, it's valuable to say, would it help if I took care of dinner today? Is there a task that you'd like me to take off your plate? So that they can make sure that the support that we give is not control. We don't want them to feel helpless. We want them just to know that they're not alone. So that's the one. I think the second one potentially would be to say that practical support can sometimes be to gently be their energy gatekeeper. It would be lovely if they can get to a place where they can pace themselves, as I indicated before, right? To be able to say, today I know that I have only so many spoons and this is what I need to give it to in order for me to get through this day. But sometimes, especially at the beginning, they might not yet. So then it is helpful to stand next to them and to gently help them to pace themselves, maybe by canceling or adjusting plans when needed, sometimes even being their social buffer when they need to go to a gathering that cannot for some reason be canceled. But at the same time, to remind them that it's okay to say no to these social gatherings if needed. The people that's close to them also has to understand that this has become a lifestyle change. So sometimes loving someone means helping them to not push themselves too hard. A third way might be to help them manage medical appointments or medication, again, if they want you to. So it can be different things. It can be to drive them to appointments, to maybe take notes when you're there, because they're often overwhelmed in a space like that, or sometimes even to be their advocate. I think something that I have found that can be helpful here is maybe even to have a shared calendar or sometimes even a symptom tracker that you can write down when there's a flare-up pattern or what can be a trigger or how would follow-up care need to be managed. So it's helpful to maybe share that between two people. There's so many things that I want to say, so I just want to make sure that I can choose the ones that potentially will add the biggest effect for the moment. Maybe it is to give support without making it about you, as difficult as that sometimes is. So it is to show up without expecting praise and without resentment. However, that can sometimes be extremely difficult to do if you feel that you have been the one that continues to give. So it takes me back to how important it is to speak to each other about all of this, right? But in principle, if you could give support without making it about you, it would be really helpful. Mm. And then maybe to avoid making them feel guilty for needing help or rest. I think that's also a very valuable one. And then maybe the last one is just to support the rest and recovery by normalizing rest. It's not laziness, it's survival. And then maybe to create opportunities for low energy connection between the two of you, to watch shows together or to listen to audiobooks or to just sit in companionable silence. But to make sure that there are still practical ways in which you guys can be close together, making sure that there is a difference between the caretaker role and then also the companion lover role.
Let's take a look at self-care, especially as it applies to the partner without the diagnosis. Why is this crucial?
This is crucial because without this, all the negative things that we've been talking about almost will be a definite. Self-care is what keeps your care from turning into self-sacrifice. It's not a luxury, it's a necessity for anyone in a supportive role especially when your partner lives with a chronic illness. In the same way that psychologists cannot go without self-care, they'll probably self-implode at some point. It's the same for the partner without a diagnosis. To make sure that there's no burnout, resentment, emotional numbness, or even health problems of your own, this is a non-negotiable. One, because you cannot pour from an empty cup. It will be important for you to make sure that with self-care, you can maintain mental and emotional balance. Supporting someone else with a chronic illness can without a doubt bring your own grief, your own frustration, your own fear, and your own helplessness. And if this is not looked at in a way that allows you to express it, there will definitely be emotional withdrawal, often depression or anxiety. So the self-care in terms of this needs to happen through journaling, through therapy, through time alone, through creative outlets, for you to be able to metabolize these complex feelings. You also need to take care of yourself in these ways to make sure that you are still aware of your own needs, your own joys, your own goals. Because often chronic illness can kind of take over a big part of the space within a relationship. And you also need to remember that you are more than just a support system. You're a full human being too. In the same way that the person with a diagnosis is more than just the diagnosis, they're a full human being too. That also counts for you as a support system. Self-care will probably also allow you to set healthy boundaries. And it will remind you that boundaries are loving, not selfish. And it might even inspire the partner with the diagnosis to see that boundaries are important. Remember that a boundary like this can sound like, I want to support you, but I need this afternoon to rest so I can come back present and grounded in order to support you again. And our hope would be that this can almost set a little bit of a precedent for how they can also speak to other people to say, hey, I really want to be your friend, but today I truly feel really bad. Can we try and postpone our coffee? And then I think it would also be to prevent compassion fatigue, as we indicated at the beginning. Self-care creates the space for renewal, right? So that your care comes from compassion and not obligation. And remember, this can be in simple but powerful ways. It can be taking a long walk alone. As I indicated, talking to a therapist or a close friend or to other family members. Having a hobby that's just yours. Something that you do not necessarily need to do together. Something that's just yours. And then often also scheduling time to rest or do nothing. I think something that I do want to add here that is very, very necessary is that the partner without the diagnosis needs to understand what it means to emotionally regulate themselves. Yes, the partner with a diagnosis also needs to understand emotional regulation without a doubt. But it's not just to the one side, it's to both. Because the regulation is what helps us to have the feeling, understand that it's valid, but to come back and act and react and speak from our wisdom as opposed to from our intense emotion. Because intense emotions often brings about that we say things that we do not mean or things that we have to say sorry for afterwards. And a big part of regulation helps us to not speak from the emotion that brings about an overreaction, but to speak from the wisdom that we have that almost comes from the place in us that wants the best for the person who lives with us. So the last thing that I want to say about this, about self-care, is that it's actually an act of love for yourself, for your partner, and for the relationship. When you care for your own well-being, you show up not as a martyr, but as a steady, resilient, whole person capable of true connection. Without self-care, unfortunately, unsteadiness, feeling flaky, feeling fragmented, probably is a given. So self-care remains a non-negotiable.
Lidalise, when living with someone with a diagnosis, how can you adapt your expectations?
I think the most important thing probably is to together redefine what normal is. So try to get away from what life should look like, what our life should look like, what our routine should be, what our energy level should be, and that anything other than that is wrong. rather go for? What does a meaningful connected life look for us now? So what does a meaningful connected life look for us now so that we can define what our normal means? Being okay with our new normal has to understand that our new normal will be different to what potentially is said it should be. So, new normal. Then the next one is to expect fluctuation, not consistency. So we shouldn't even feel that we're frustrated when it's not consistent, because that's not what our life looks like for now. We expect fluctuation. So we need to know that there's good days, bad days, and unpredictable days. So practice flexibility. That can be a valuable way to adapt the expectation from consistency to fluctuation. Then I think another valuable one would probably be to say that we adjust our expectation of emotional availability by asking each other where we're at, what is possible for today, ask about how many spoons they have available to both partners, and to talk, to converse about what we can do today, what we can't do today, and to make sure that you do not take the limitations personally. So be mindful in that way, to not take the fact that they have two spoons today personally, again, to both sides. Then maybe even update your role expectations, right? Like, what does support look like for both people? Not just for the one or for the other, but for both people. And I think these expectations can sometimes come from a traditional view of how a marriage should look like, what responsibility which partner might have. And therefore, it is important to really say, let's throw the rule book out the window. Let's say what I need based on my situation and what you need based on your situation. Then I think the last thing would be to practice grace over perfection. So yes, chronic illness can make both of you irritable, forgetful, and overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. So release the expectations of constant emotional poise, tidy spaces, or calm communication. Know that it is an emotionally laden environment. Make sure that you don't hurt each other, but understand that things will not always be tidy, calm, and refined. So these two phrases are things that probably needs to become part of your daily mantra. The first is, we both snapped, let's reset. We both snapped, let's reset. Second one, it wasn't perfect, but we did our best. It wasn't perfect, but we did our best. So a big part of adapting your expectation should be from perfection to we embrace repair. And guys, again, here I want to say that this thing about you both snapped, let's reset. If all marriages, if all partnerships, if all companionships can have that, regardless of whether there's a chronic illness that's part of the picture, it can change the landscape of marriages. It can change the landscape of relationships. So in a way, if the chronic illness can bring this about, that you have grace over perfection, you're probably further than marriages where there is no diagnosis part of the picture. Mm. Then I think maybe the real, real last one would be to adapt your expectations to expecting meaning, not always ease. So to know that life might be harder in some ways, but deeper in others. So adjusting expectations will help you to find richness in small moments, gratitude in the presence, and intimacy in the shared resilience that you guys have together. So to expect meaning and not always ease. And then I think the comment that I just want to close with is that adapted expectations don't mean lowered standards. They just mean wiser ones. It's not lowered standards. It's wiser ones.
Thank you, Lida Lees. Where can listeners learn more about your work or follow you?
So, because of my own self-care, and I think the way in which I try to sometimes shield myself from the world burning, I myself am not on a lot of social media. So I do have a website and my number is public. So if it is needed for you to engage in some way, to ask whether this is something that I can help with, you're more than welcome to set up a quick call. That would definitely be my first, or send an email to my email address. I'm quite sure that that can be something that is shared. It's also available on the website. And anything other than that, I almost want you to, I want to invite you to come here and to learn how things would happen in person.
Thank you. And I will share your website and your email address in the podcast notes if that works for you.
Yes, that's perfect.
Thank you. May I now ask your fun question?
Of course, I'm ready.
Little Lise, we're going to the realm of the imagination. I was wondering if you could dream up an imaginary friend, what sort of friend would that be?
I think in my mind I have, I'm not sure how many people have seen the movie If stands for imaginary friend.
Oh.
And it's a brilliant movie, by the way, if you haven't seen it yet. And I think a big part of what the movie is trying to explain is how we probably all had that at some point in our life and how it was there to protect us. And whether that is a big purple teddy bear, whether that is a small butterfly, and that there were true engagement with this imaginary friend. And I think the movie is also trying to say we all should have access to our imaginary friends because they actually still exist. So I think I have to say what my if looks like. I think it is a bigger version of me. You know what? I think I'll change that actually. I think it's maybe a smaller version of me. If I have to think of an imaginary friend for myself today, it would probably be the little girl that I was when I was, I think, about 5 years old.
Mm.
I think after 5 years old, the world changed me a little bit. But I think until that time, I was very carefree. And I think I loved everything in the world and I wanted to see everything. And there was kind of like no fear, right? So I think I would want that part of me. I would want that part of me to spend time with me, in a sense, reminding me to not be fearful and to engage in new things and to almost throw caution to the wind and to, kind of just love life. I think if I have to think back what kind of imaginary friend I would have wanted for my little girl, it would probably be a version of an older, wiser, protective, loving, caring version of me, so that I almost know that I could trust it. I could trust it because it's me in the future. Mm. Yeah, so I think for now, it would probably be my little five-year-old version.
Mm. Thank you, Lida Lise. And thank you for your many insights. I must say, I'm quite flabbergasted by everything you've mentioned, and I would really like to overthink many of those I would say illuminated moments again, and the practical advice, much practical advice, as you said, or as you indicated, also applying to other relationships, not only to this type of relationship we've been considering today. So thank you very, very much for giving so much from your experience and from your heart.
That is a big pleasure, Mariette. I want to hear whether it is possible for me to maybe just conclude with two sentences.
Yes.
Okay. I think if there's one thing that I want people to go home with, I think it would probably be to continue to talk. If you continue to talk with each other, you will always be able to find a way. But talk from the vulnerable space in you, and not necessarily from the part in you that feels that you need to defend, the part in you that feels that it needs to protect you, the part of yourself that needs to be strong. Allow yourself to be vulnerable with the other person and continue to try. If you fall down 1,000 times, get up 1,001 times. You do not have to do this alone. Reach out for other people to help. It's like building a puzzle, one little tiny piece at a time. So talk and continue to try.
Thank you. And to our listeners, it was good of you to join us. If you found this episode meaningful, please share it with someone you care about. Go to my website,
www.marietsneeman.co.za for this episode's podcast notes and for free podcasts and articles on how to live a happier and healthier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, just search for Mariette Sneeman Journalist. The podcast series, Calm, Clear and Helpful, is produced by me with original music by Mart Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9.